Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Literature channel of the New Books Network. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. Today, I have the honor to interview Fida Jiris, who is a Palestinian writer and editor who has written on life as a Palestinian in Israel and the West Bank. Fida was raised by Palestinian parents in Lebanon and later in Cyprus and then back in Israel to the West Bank. Therefore, Fida has a unique ability to look at the Palestinian community from both, from the inside as a native, but also from the outside as an outsider, as someone who came to her land only later as an adult. Fida has published 3 collections of Arabic short stories depicting life in Palestine, one of which, Al-Hawajaj, a gentleman in English, was recently made into a theater production. The book we'll focus today about, his name in Hebrew is Hakluv, or in English, The Cage, is a Hebrew anthology of selected short stories by Fida Jiris, which he originally published in Arabic. The stories speak of the life of Palestinians in Israel and in the West Bank. Through these snapshots of daily life, the book attempts to portray the complex realities of living on both sides of the divide, examining issues of politics, but also about identity, gender, and poverty, and the human toll we all pay by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This interview is my way to try to invite you, the listeners, not only to listen to dialogues and lectures about the conflict, but to speak and listen to the people from the area, the people who are part of the conflict and suffering from the conflict, the Palestinian and the Israelis. Fida, thank you so much for joining the New Books Network. I'm really honored that you are with us.
Thank you so much, Yakir. I'm very happy to be with you today.
Thank you. So I want to start with to ask you, your book, you wrote it in Arabic, the short stories. And then it is now translated and it is in Hebrew. And I wonder, when you wrote these stories, did you imagine that Israelis, Hebrew speakers, are going to read your stories? And how do you feel about that?
Okay, I began writing, I have 3 collections of Arabic short stories, and I began writing about 15 years ago. In that time, I published 3 books. Definitely, during the time of writing them, I did not even imagine that they would be translated to Hebrew or read by Israelis. I was simply writing them in Arabic. Even the thought of translation to English wasn't on my mind at that point. I was simply writing these stories in my language and publishing them in books. The stories also came from a background where I have always felt like an alien or a stranger to Israeli society, like most Palestinians feel to varying degrees. And when recently, only in the last few years, when I began to, it started out by speaking to Israeli activists for peace and so on. And slowly it morphed, as it always does, into my fiction work as well. When Van Leer Institute expressed interest in translating my stories for an anthology they were doing, I was cautious, and I didn't really know how to process that. And I said yes. And even back then, when the book wasn't even mine, I mean, I had two stories in an anthology by Van Leer Institute called Belashon Kruta, Amputated Tongue. When I first received a copy of the book and I flicked through, I can read the basic Hebrew. I flicked through and I found the stories and I found my name and I began to read some of the text. It was a very surreal feeling. Definitely not something I would ever have expected. When that road continued and Van Leer said, we want to do a book specifically for you, we want to do a collection of short stories only by you, and it's going to be your book, I was really floored. I was shocked. It was nothing I would ever have expected. I always felt that as Palestinians and Israelis, we lead very, very segregated lives in the state. And suddenly being able to for my voice to reach Jewish Israelis was very profound for me when I really paused to think about it. And here we are, and I really am hoping that as many people will get to read this book as possible, and even more, I'm hoping to hear people's reactions. It would be very, very profound and interesting for me.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, something that we're going to speak in this podcast is I felt as I was reading your stories already in the anthology and now in your book that there is never one person to be blamed. There is something much more nuanced, much more soft. And maybe if it's okay, Fida, I want to start with the idea of the stranger. Mm-hmm. Because there is, in many of your stories, there is someone who is a stranger. I mean, it starts with the Hawaja about like a person who come clearly from Europe and he come to learn about the Palestinian culture much before Israel is Israel. It looks that it happened much before. And then there is a clash between what does it mean to be at home and who is a stranger. And then later we have the Turkish who come and conquer the land, right? And they also try to force the Palestinian to serve in their military. And who is a stranger? And you end and you say, I think in the end of the stories, and someone will come again.
Yes.
And we know, right? And we know that the British will come and then the Israelis will come. Or the Egyptian came and the Jordanian come. What is stranger for you when you write these stories?
A stranger, in reflecting, I did not really realize this at the time, or I think I wasn't fully conscious of this. But after the process of writing the stories and some years later, the more I talk to people about them, and especially after they were translated to Hebrew, I started to realize that perhaps subconsciously, I am speaking about my own feeling of being a stranger in this land wherever I go. And I will explain a little bit. I was born outside Israel. My parents are from a village in the Galilee called Fasota, a small village. In 1970, my father was exiled from Israel due to his political activism and work. We ended up living in Beirut and then in Cyprus, and it was only after the Oslo Accords that we were allowed back. My father had then been in exile for 24 years. I came back at 22 years of age. I set foot in this country for the first time. I had no idea what to expect. I had grown up with Palestine in our home all the time. My father worked as the director of the Palestine Research Center in Beirut. That belonged to the PLO. And, you know, all our lives had been shaped by the question of Palestine and by the conflict. When I came back, I was so happy to come back to my parents' birthplace, to their village. But I didn't really anticipate in full what it meant to come back, first of all, to my own culture, having grown up outside it, in the village and so on. And second, and more importantly, perhaps, what it meant to come back to live as a Palestinian in the state of Israel, particularly a Palestinian who had not grown up there and therefore didn't know anything about the system and the daily life there. I, for many, many years, I continued to feel like a stranger, despite all my efforts. And when people look at me, they think I've assimilated and integrated very well. I have, you know, large, obviously extended family. I have so many friends, so many networks, people I know. And yet, I have never really felt like I was able to completely fit in. Some years after that, I went to Canada. Again, I was a stranger, but okay, that's not my country, so to speak. I came back here and I came back to Ramallah, hoping to find more belonging, you know, among, let's say, in a Palestinian atmosphere and so on. Again, for many reasons, again, it's a little bit less here, but I still feel in so many aspects like a stranger. This theme of not really belonging anywhere, I started to explore in a lot more detail, I think, even if subconsciously, when I was writing. What defines the belonging to a place? And what defines your feeling that you belong or you don't, even though you may biologically or by family ancestry belong, and yet you haven't lived there? This belonging, does it change over time? Does it shift? What is our relation to strange people who come from outside and occupy and inhabit our country? And like you said, Yakir, there have been so many of them in succession. So really, this concept of a stranger remains, it's a thread in all my life. And I just published a book in English, Stranger in My Own Land, that describes my and my family's history. These stories in Hakluv, the book we're talking about today, really came as snapshots from my own experience of living in Israel and then in the West Bank, of daily life. And I felt many times like I was in the role of the observer. I was absorbing many things and reflecting on many things, and they started coming out as these fictional stories.
Wow. I think about two things. Like, now I understand so much better the dialogue. I mean, in your short story, The Cage, which is the name of the book, Hakluv, there is a dialogue among two women in a taxi that they ask the question that you just said, is it better? Because they are in a checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem. But
yes,
actually, they can live in Jerusalem, but they don't feel at home. And they live in Ramallah, but then the checkpoint makes them not to feel home. And then they said, was it better before the Oslo Accord, before the Palestinian Intifada, that we could drive in 10 minutes from Jerusalem? And then you end the story with a kid who just, a baby who just cry. And then, but now it's cry on the other side because they just passed the checkpoint, right?
Yes.
Do I say it right?
Yes. And I suppose the child's crying on both sides really reflects how I feel, Yakir, that Palestinians are really crying on both sides of the divide. Wherever you go in this country, there is really no relief. There isn't really one place in which you feel that you are treated as a fully equal and dignified human being. And this is very painful. And the questions these women were asking were very real. Thousands of Palestinians are forced to live in Kfar Aqab, which is a suburb of Jerusalem, in order to retain their Jerusalemite residency because of Israel's law that for Palestinian residents, if they stay for more than, I don't know how long it is today, but it used to be 7 years, then it was, I believe, two or something outside the city, they actually lose their residency. So these people found themselves, after the separation wall was built and Colindia checkpoint, they found themselves essentially living on the other side of the checkpoint, in other words, inside the territory of, let's say, Ramallah. But they continued to hold their Jerusalem ID or Jerusalem residency because, according to the accords and the agreements, Kfar Aqab remained a suburb of Jerusalem. These people are essentially caught in no man's land. They don't belong in full here or there. And this story tried to explain that, this terrible sense of inner discord that these people have trying to navigate their lives and to answer the question, you know, why can I not move freely and live wherever I want, like any normal citizen in any normal country?
Is there also And it's a question that I'm reflecting for many years, and I want your help. Because the woman, she says also, I remember the old time, like before, I guess, before the Oslo Accord, but also before the Intifada, when we could drive in 10 minutes. Is it also, I don't know how to ask it nicely, but is it also in a way a wish or a regret on the Intifada? What's going on in the life of people that before they could drive in 10 minutes, but no one gave them any identity? I mean, no one looked at them as Palestinian. No one, I think, in Israel saw them. Now everyone see them maybe as an enemy, but now they need to drive for 2 hours each day to cross. Yes. What's going on in the narrative?
Yes, there is a very powerful feeling among all Palestinians. I think by today, almost any Palestinian you ask will share this feeling. There is a huge feeling of letdown and despair and frustration at the Oslo Accords themselves, at their outcome, at the so-called peace process, and the fact that it brought neither peace nor solutions nor anything really. And people, I think, are referring in this story, they are referring to a point in time when they could still almost hang on to some kind of hope before this whole process, before the Oslo Accords and so on. They could hang on to some kind of hope that perhaps something in future would happen to make things right. The important thing to understand here is that when the accords themselves were signed, large parts of the people, myself included, who were not really privy to all the details and the technicalities and so on of the accords, you know, we were not so, you know, really immersed in them politically to understand really what was going on. Looking at them as they were at face value, this is a process of peace and reconciliation. So many decades of hatred and conflict and so on are somehow going to come to an end. There will be a Palestinian state on the horizon. People's imagination ran wild. You know, there will be peace and security. There will be economic cooperation between the forthcoming Palestine and Israel. There will be peace. You know, we will somehow try to navigate forward in this country. But it is much, much worse to have your hopes go so high and then to have them dashed than to have no hope at all. This is what I try to capture here. When the woman is telling her friend in the car, we used to be able to cross to Jerusalem in 10 minutes. She's really saying we were on the verge. We were still at a point when there was some hope on the horizon. And now the checkpoint very much is not just physical. It's also psychological. Now there has been a cutoff, a severing, an immense renewal of hostility and a complete breakdown and inability to move beyond this point.
Thank you,
Fida. As tragic as that is. But, you know, I mean, I live in Ramallah at the moment. This is the reality we see and we grapple with every minute of every day.
Yeah, yes. And then it's even more complicated because you are asking, you go deeper and deeper. Like I felt sometimes in reading the stories that it's almost like an onion. Like I cried about, you know, the strangers who tried to control. And then I said like, okay. And then now there is a story not about strangers. There is a story about women and men.
Yes.
But then you make us to cry again because something about the way how you speak about the gender dynamic brings a lot of pain. And maybe we can focus on very naive story. The story where there is a stranger again who come by a peace, you know, one of these peace organizations to come and teach yoga. Yes, yeah. Just to teach, right, how to breathe. Like she come to teach the Palestinian woman how to be free.
Yes.
And, you know, I think many international people come to Palestine and they come to Israel to teach how to do peace, and they speak big words about MLK and Mahatma Gandhi. And but then we have that woman that a month before someone came to teach them about sexuality. And she almost, as a director of the center, she almost lost all the center. And now someone come to teach about yoga. And this woman tried to understand what we and yoga, how should we breathe when we have kids at home, an angry husband because he cannot work? What's going on? Yeah, lead us in this sensitive, very vulnerable, I think, walk between gender.
Yes, Palestinian society is traditional in its gender relations. And, you know, it has specified roles, I suppose, like every other society, you know, for men and women. A lot of that obviously has been changing, like in other countries around the world over the past, you know, few decades. You know, with the advent of technology and women working outside the home and more education and so on. Here, I am really examining the role. I mean, they happen to be women. I chose them as women because women bear the brunt of so much that goes on here. The woman does not just bear the brunt of the terrible political and social catastrophe that the Palestinian people live under. She also is tasked with caring for the home and for the children and being a sounding board or a safety net for everybody, and often having to quell her own needs, her own wants, or let's say her own safety herself in order to provide it to others. Women have, Palestinian women have been forced to be in very, very difficult and challenging, terrible, terrible things really have been expected of them, really requiring superhuman strength. And in fact, it is no exaggeration to say they are probably some of the strongest women I have met. People whose children are in prison, people whose husbands have died in the conflict, people who don't know exactly where they're going to put the next meal from for their family. In my life in Ramallah, I observed a lot of these foreign, you know, intervention programs that we have, and it makes me very, very, very upset. And it makes a lot of other Palestinians very upset as well, because there is, despite the seeming well-meaning, and I will be a bit frank or candid in my appraisal here, despite the so-called, you know, well-meaning intentions and so on to relieve poverty, to relieve, you know, to provide sustainable livelihoods and so on, the way we feel as Palestinians is all these organizations try to simply put a plaster on the wound without addressing the root cause of this wound. In other words, none of them are working actively to do anything to end the occupation, which is the source of this pain we're in. Instead, they are saying, here, take this aspirin, you know, let's build you a small shop here where you can live from. Let's give you a little program here to teach you, I don't know, needlework or something. Let's come and, you know, teach you about breastfeeding. I mean, this was a joke a few years ago, you know, this big NGO came and it was giving all this instruction to, you know, Palestinian women about, you know, the benefits of breastfeeding and so on. Women, Palestinian women have been breastfeeding for generations. So yeah. It's like, okay, what are you coming to teach us? You know, I mean, you know, what are you telling me here? It's something that, you know, that I'm already doing. And there is a lot of talk about, you know, sustainability and about capacity building and about state building. There is no state. There isn't a state on the horizon. There isn't basic liberation from occupation. What are we talking about here? And so this mounting, you know, cynicism that Palestinians feel towards this, and I say this in the stories, one character is saying to the other, oh, we have NGOs for everything. We have NGOs for women and for children and for art and for culture. And this is true. You know, anything under the sun, they will simply pour some money into it in order to give some money to these poor beneficiaries and to keep them silent. And this is the immense frustration that I was trying to reflect in this story, perhaps through, you know, black humor in that sense. The women are joking to each other. You know, this woman is talking about yin and yang.
Yes.
And one of the women has a son who has just been arrested. They can't afford a lawyer, arrested by the Israeli military. They can't afford a lawyer. Her husband is unemployed. She's worried about her other kids. And here she is in this room with a woman that's talking about inner peace, the, you know. And this, you know, this is what I was trying to capture with this story, the surreal, surreal world in which we live in this part of the world.
Thank you, Fida. And I wonder, as I continue to read the stories, I found myself that it's really hard to breathe.
Yes.
It's right. It's really hard to breathe because for two reasons. One, there is no time to breathe. And I think about this story about the grandma that she is very poor. And like she's waking up at 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. to start making bread. And this is what she's doing all day, to take care of the grandchildren and her husband and the men and everyone. And then she just fall into a deep sleep, hopefully, because she needs to wake up very soon. And I wonder, Fida, where is the amal? Where is the hope? Where is the breath that you find in life and you want to bring into the stories?
It's interesting you're asking that question now, Yakir, because to be honest now, especially in the recent events here in the country, the election of this new government, for example, and the
of
terrible
Israel.
Spiral on Israel, and the terrible spiral of violence we've had over the last, I suppose, 2 years now. This year in particular, in terms of statistics, a higher number of Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank than in any other year. So really, they are the largest number. It has really, it's really breaking down completely. And any person who is following the news can see this. If I am to be painfully honest at this point in time, as I answer you this question, I can truthfully say I find it very difficult to garner any hope. However, having said that, I think subconsciously we find the hope and we cling to it. Otherwise, I would not write. I would not be speaking to you today about this. I would not continue to find every Jewish and every Israeli person who will listen and go and speak to them and nurture these relationships, even though when there is immense pain involved. And I would not, you know, continue seeing my friends, and we talk and we vent and we do all these things. And at some points, it all seems so unbelievably dark, especially when everybody around you, this is not just my own feeling, everybody, just now, just before this, I was sitting with two friends and three friends, and one of them was saying, nothing will change. This will not, it's not, nothing will move forward. You are working against that tide every single day and trying to, when you wake up in the morning, to find a reason for living, really, some days, because everything around you, I mean, the minute you wake up, you are pummeled by something in the news, and it just, from there, it just goes downhill until the rest of the day. Hope is found. I think one of the most profound sources of hope for me is in finding like-minded people to speak to and to continue working. Because in any situation, when you're faced with something that's so formidable that you can't do anything about it, essentially what you have to do is find that small crack. Find that small crack, and from which you can do something. Because doing something is at least better than just succumbing to all the pain, which would be a collective suicide in that sense.
Thank you for saying that. Because, and I think I really felt it, because a lot of the figures in the stories, sometimes they don't even have the gift or the privilege to do something because it's so stuck, like in the checkpoint, for example, or when the group of people are sitting inside a taxi who drive like crazy and they just stuck, right? Until an accident will happen at one point. And now I understand that maybe I didn't read well the short story about the grandma, because maybe her life, at least she's doing constantly things.
Yes.
Right? At least she is a grandma. She is bringing a next generation of Palestinian kids, and she loves them.
She loves them. I'm also speaking about the brunt that this takes on the person in a daily life. The fact that, you know, people like these, for example, have never heard of something called the holiday or vacation, or, you know, things that other people take for granted. People like this don't really have the time to sit and reflect about things as we do. This woman of this story is actually real. She is one of the members of my extended family. And sometimes I could maybe catch her, you know, in a quiet moment, having a coffee or something, and I would begin asking her about something, about her life. And I always felt there was a reluctance to speak. There was a reluctance to answer my questions. When I tried, you know, to ask her a little bit more about her life, her feelings, and so on, the reason is that these feelings are too painful, and this life has too much pain in it. And so a lot of people, and I've seen this a lot, both among Palestinians in Israel and those here in the West Bank, people will often drown their sorrows in work. And if not in work, in just being busy all the time, in being busy all the time, because, you know, this is a psychological mechanism as well. It's if you're running away from something, the last thing you want is to sit down and reflect and think about it, because it's so horrible that you are afraid that you will simply break down. And I felt this over and over in interviews that I did with my family members for my other book, For Stranger in My Own Land. Sometimes I had to stop the interviews. People broke down. And a couple of them have, one of them has diabetes. He broke down. I was afraid because his sugar suddenly shot up. His sugar level. I mean, you are talking about real, real and tangible almost pain. And people mask it in different ways. Constant work and productivity can be one of those ways, as can be the other extreme, the detachment from society, the constant cynicism, what's all this for? There's no point. And then people engage in, you know, destructive behavior, in drinking, in, you know, abusing drugs and so on. So we have all those social problems here, just like, you know, any people in any country. But here they are compounded by this terrible reality that we are experiencing, that we live in for so many decades now with no end in sight.
Thank you, Fida. And it leads me to one of the stories where we have Walid, who is sitting in jail, in Israeli jail, for like 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now released. And you call the story The Other Fences, Gderot Acherot.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that gave some maybe hope to Walid in the prison, which is interesting because a prison, it's a time that you can think a lot. And I want to ask you, from your experience, how Israeli prison influence Palestinians, because it's like, it's a place where, you know, they cannot do, or they cannot run away from not thinking. And he has Lama. He has, right, this woman that he knew as a child, because he was arrested from the story when he's like 17 or 18 or something like that. And now she's a widow with five kids, and he's even afraid to contact with her.
Yes. Yes. So he leaves. So he has this hope. And I don't know if it's a hope as such. He has this recurrent dream during his years in prison. He's in prison, I think, in the story for 20 or 25 years.
Yes.
And this is the strength or the power of the social taboos. I explain somewhere in the story that even between him and himself, when he was thinking about her in prison, he would be ashamed. And I'm talking here about this, you know, young, you know, an adolescent, basically, when he was arrested. And about how, you know, obviously he's now in prison. So he's going through the levels of, you know, maturity, of puberty and of maturity and so on. And so it's only natural that he would think about somebody he loves and this thought process will continue regardless of where he is, if he's in prison or he's outside. But he feels the social taboo is so powerful to think of somebody when you are not married to them, for example, or, you know, that he feels ashamed even between him and himself. So again, we have another wall, another fence here, his own fence. That is, you know, when he finally leaves the prison, it's all he can think about. He wants to see this woman again. He clashes with the fences outside. Okay, he is in a traditional society. There is no meaning whatsoever for somebody to go and contact a widow. That he is not her cousin. He is not, let's say, related to her. He doesn't have, let's say, a social excuse or, you know, to go and see this woman or visit. And so, you know, he comes up against all these powerful fences, the fences of people's thinking. After thinking that he has left the prison, he comes up against the social fences. And here I speak about a very complex interplay between our own society and our own taboos, as well as the added layer of the Israeli occupation and its restraints and its terrible conditions that it imposes upon people. So جدران أخرى, other fences, other walls, they are everywhere. They are within the individual themselves. They are wrought upon by society and they are wrought on by the occupation. Going back, Yakir, to what you said at the beginning about the onion, they are layers.
Where do we go from here, Fida? As a writer, how do you, what is the position when you sit and, because when you sit and write, I mean, you're reflecting. I mean, it was a really beautiful, like it's such a human book, such humanistic.
Thank you.
And
thank
so
you.
Painful. Mm-hmm. And honestly, as an Israeli who now live in the United States, in a way, I felt relief. Oh, thanks God that I'm not anymore, you know, in a way.
Yes, yes.
And I wonder, you're writing now from Ramallah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work as a writer?
Between, sometimes I call it between the raindrops, in the sense that there's so much pummeling you every day. Some stuff you deliberately choose not to engage with. And some stuff that rises to in your consciousness so much that you feel compelled to write about it. This process of selection, first of all, is absolutely necessary because otherwise you could go crazy. There are really too many stressors, too many at the same time, for you to be able to exist while tackling them all. As a writer, I think in recent times, what has happened is I'm writing more and more about things that really... how do I say, really provoke me, really, you know, the things sort of that most make me angry, upset, you know, both internally in our own society. I have, you know, a lot of issues I want to write about and also about the facets of the occupation. And as a writer, I think you are privileged always, because I think it's a double-edged sword. It's a privilege and it's also a curse, because you are in a constant state of observation, whether you like it or not. That's just the way your brain operates. And that is ultimately what translates into these stories and these articles and these books. The state of observation almost allows you at times to look at something. I call it the fly on the wall syndrome. So you are looking at it almost like you are not part of the situation. You are able to detach yourself, even when you are in it, to detach yourself, to almost be observing it as though you were an outsider. At the same time, you are extremely involved in it to the point where you can analyze and you know what's going on. That's why I call it a curse also, because this process never stops. It's almost like you can never be in any situation at which you can just interact with things superficially and move on. Everything leaves a mark. Everything is open to later reflection and interpretation. Sometimes not even not voluntarily or willingly, you may find yourself thinking about a particular situation days later or weeks later, and it will come up in your writing. At the moment, how I navigate, I think, is, you know, I'm promoting my books at the moment. I'm not doing too much writing these days, although I have a couple of articles here and there. I think at the moment also I'm under the same shock, I would call it, as many other people, that we are just watching the situation around us and waiting to see what will transpire, hoping against hope that some ray of light will find its way through. But a lot of us are shell-shocked. I mean, following the violence, you know, the recent spates of violence and, you know, this new elections and so on, a lot of us, I feel now, are in a state where we are just staring into space, so to speak. And I think for the writing, what this usually does, it brings about a delayed reaction later, not while you are actually experiencing this.
Fida, I just want to remind the listeners that also you just published a book in English. Inshallah, we're going to do hopefully another podcast about that. Can you just say, please, the title of the book in English?
Yes, of course. It's called The Stranger in My Own Land. It's published by Hearst in London in partnership with Oxford University Press in the States. And it was released in October, just a month ago.
As we say, congratulations, mazal tov.
Thank you.
Fida, thank you so much for coming to the New Books Network. It's a real gift to listen and to read your stories.
Thank you very much, Yakir. I'm very happy to speak with you today. Thank you with all my heart.